I would like to start by thanking the organizers for inviting me to this talk. And to begin with, I want to say that my talk is based on joint work with Tom Parker. And we've been working on this for a while, and well, some of you have heard me talk about this before. I think we have made some, the situation turned out to be more complicated than we thought originally, but then at the end it turned out to be simpler, if you look at it from the right perspective. So let me start first with some background and motivation to begin with. So, so for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to take X, I'm going to take X to be a symplectic threefold. I mean six real dimensions, say complex. And the question we were interested in is, what is the structure of the Gromov-Witten invariant of X? So now, of course, this is the last day of the workshop, and you've seen this before, but just to set up notation and everything, let me just briefly mention. So what are the Gromov-Witten invariants of X? We basically start with a genus G Riemann surface, and we look at holomorphic maps, F, into X, that represent, the image represents a fixed homology class. So we have a homology class in H2 of X, and then G is the genus. And if you look at the moduli space of such holomorphic maps, the expected dimension for a Calabi-Yau threefold, let me denote this moduli space of mass by MGAX, is C1. So this is, again, expected complex dimension. Some of the dimensions in this talk are going to be real, but most of them are going to be complex. So in order not to confuse the audience, I'll try to you'll see. This is complex dimension. So this is complex dimension. It's C1 of X on A. So you notice one particular thing is the dimension is independent of the genus. And in particular, if X is a Calabi-Yau threefold, that means C1 of X is zero. That's also independent, so dimension is zero, independent of anything. Right? All dimensions are zero, independent of genus and the homology class. So then the Gromov-Witten invariant, genus GA of X, is the number of, we have to perturb. So perturbed holomorphic maps as above, but you have to count them. So you have to count them with sign, with a certain sign given by the spectral flow, but also and a factor. And the factor of this should be 1 over the number of automorphisms of this map, of this, well, pair, really, F, comma, sigma, comma, a complex structure on the domain, on sigma. So 1 over number of automorphisms. So, for example, if you're in a Calabi-Yau threefold, you end up getting a rational number in general. If you are, in general, for a general threefold, so if the dimension, so for example, if C1 on X on A is positive, so this expected dimension is positive, what you need to do, you need to cut down by constraints. And for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to only cut down by constraints which are pulled back by evaluation from the target. So cut down by constraints. Pulled back. Well, maybe say it this way. Maybe I'll just say it shortly. By what kind of constraints? Constraints are always going to be of the type evaluation pullback of a homology class, or cohomology if you want, where H is in the cohomology of X with Z coefficients. So I'm not going to put any descendants on these. And once you cut down bind constraints to be zero dimensional, you choose your constraints appropriately, so the space of solutions that are passing through these constraints is zero dimensional, then you can do the same count and get a rational number. So now, of course, when we asked this question, what's the structure of Gromov-Witten invariants of X, we were motivated by two things, by, well, several conjectures. So what are the conjectures? And you've heard them before in the conjectures. You have heard it before in this workshop. So there are several conjectures about this Gromov-Witten invariance of a threefold, especially if it's a Calabi-Yau threefold, or maybe if it's a Fano threefold in the Keller category. The first conjecture is the Gopakuma-Vafa conjecture. And that's the first one. Historically, they conjecture that, I forgot one piece of notation. Just as far as notation is concerned, here I'm counting curves with a connected domain, as I said, so it's a genus G domain. But you can also do the same thing and get an invariant GV tilde GA, which does the very same count, but it has possibly disconnected domain. So it's possibly disconnected domains. And of course, then the genus doesn't make sense, but you look at the Euler characteristic. The Euler characteristic of the domain would have to be 2 minus 2g. So let's see. So the GV conjecture says that if you look at this disconnected count, so if you sum, so let's say this way. So the GV conjecture says that if X is a Calabi-Yau threefold, then the sum over the genus and the homology class of the Gromov-Witten invariants, this disconnected ones, on AG, on GA, and you put some variables, 2 to the 2G minus 2, Q to the A, this is the same. Let's take the sum here for over classes where A is not equal to 0 for simplicity, and let's do the same thing here, and some let's say H, it's a sum over n, another kind of invariant, n a h, sum over d equals to 1 to infinity, 1 over d sine of dt over 2 to the power 2h minus 2 q to the dA. Okay? Where now, so these are the Gromov-Witten invariants, and this is the BPS invariant, BPS count, which is supposed to be an integer. So you already see that if you somehow naturally, if you take disconnected curves, holomorphic curves, and you make this change of variables in a sense in the series, you are expected to get this other invariant, the BPS count, which is an integer invariant instead of a rational invariant. And then the second conjecture is the MNOP conjecture, the Maulik-Nekrasov-Okunkov-Panhalepande conjecture, that says, let me first state it when X is a Calabi-Yau threefold for simplicity, but, well, maybe I should state it in general, so let's see. Let's put it this way. So if X is Keller with C1 greater or equal to 0, then we have sort of a similar structure for the Gromov-Witten invariant, the sum over GA, let's say A not equal to 0, of, again, disconnected covers. There is a strange shift in the indexing here. C1 of the manifold enters on A, on the homology class A, but it's the same information, is the same as the sum over G, let's say A not equal to 0, the same, not G, N, and A not equal to 0 of the Dolan-Fontomas invariant. We'll put a 0 here. AN minus E to the IT to the N Q, N plus C1 of A over 2 So where these are, this here now are the Donaldson-Thomas invariants. But they're the, sort of the reduced Donaldson-Thomas invariants. What you do, you basically take the full Donaldson-Thomas invariants series, just like this, and then you divide by the over the sum over the class A equals to zero of the Donaldson-Thomas invariant, and that so it's the sum over all A's here over the sum over A equals to zero. You divide formally, and you get this reduced Donaldson-Thomas invariant. So it's, all this data is the same. It's the DT0 invariant. So these are the two conjectures. And again, these Donaldson-Thomas invariants, they appear before in this workshop, and they are integers. So you again see that even though Gromov-Witten invariants discount of disconnected curves is a fraction, when you make the appropriate change of variables, you get an integer invariant. And the motivation for this conjecture, in a sense, is that, after all, both all these three different invariants are really supposed to count the same object, but maybe in a different fashion. So they all count the same object, but differently somehow. So what are the objects? In an ideal situation, the objects are simply holomorphic curves. You want to think of them that what you are counting is possibly disconnected holomorphic curves, actually, and points. So you've got points. This corresponds to the homology class equals to zero there, constant maps, if you want. And maybe there are some points here over there. So there are some if you want, in principle, there should be some embedded holomorphic curves. And then each such holomorphic curve would have a certain multiplicity. And we've got a bunch of points. Some of the points are sort of distributed on the curve. Some of them are sort of away from the curves. And if you think about it, both the Gromov-Witten invariant counts this kind of object, but it counts them as maps in. So it counts them as maps from a disconnected domain, from a possible disconnected domain in. So these points would be corresponding to constant maps, and this multiplicity would be corresponding to a degree D cover, branch cover, of this embedded curve. And the same situation would be happening here. Here you are counting ideal shift support on curves. When you have this DT0, you are basically removing these points. So you are just reducing the problem to the situation of counting ideal shift supporting on a curve and possibly some points on this curve. So that's sort of the moral story. And so now what we've been trying to understand, this picture a bit better. So what we can prove is the following, and I'll explain the notation. So there is a well-defined invariant, symplectic invariant, which I'm going to denote by GR AG. Again, disconnect, let's see. There is a version for connected and there is a version for the disconnected curve. The difference between the connected and disconnected curve is just to exponentiate one of the power series, the connected series, to get a disconnected series. So let's say it for the disconnected curve, there is a well-defined invariant such that, again, this is only in a situation where we have a Calabi-Yau when we have a symplectic threefold, so such that the Gromov-Witten series is given by the following formula. So the sum over A not equal to zero and over the genus of this disconnected Gromov-Witten invariant is the same as the sum over, again, A not equal to zero and the genus of this other Gromov invariant, GA. And now you have 2 sine of T over 2 to the power 2G minus 2 plus C1 of A. And furthermore, so let's see. So, well, this invariants have a geometric meaning. So what is GR, GA? The simple situation is when, so if C1 on A is positive, then this invariant is just a count. So GR tilde, GA, is just a count of embedded J almost, so J is an almost complex structure, J holomorphic curves on X. So, and then, so it's an integer, of course. I should say, that's sort of the upshot. And when C1 of A is 0, let me do this. So now when it has a sign. By the spectral flow of the dx operator. So the operator is a real operator. So you have to flow it to a complex operator. And you count the number of times you cross real R kernel. So if you cross a number, an even number of times the sign is plus, if you cross an odd number of, if you hit a kernel, an R kernel, an odd number of times the sign is minus. So it's an integer, but it's not positive. So it's a count of embedded curves with sign, given by the spectral flow of the linearized operator. So let's see. And now what happens is the situation is much more complicated when C1, so when C1 of A equals to 0, this GR tilde of GA, what we should think of it is, let me say it this way, so I'll explain this later, so it's a weighted count of, well, morally, again, embedded J holomorphic curves but you should really think of it as sort of J holomorphic curves with some marking. So J holomorphic curves, J holomorphic, I'll explain this, curves with, it's an extra marking. They are smooth, all smooth, yes, but J almost complex. So, well, so right, I should say embedded smooth. Well, it will become apparent shortly. Embedded smooth. No, so what? Well, in order to count, you cut down by constraints of that type. Okay. So then the top dimension would be embedded and smooth. Of course, if you didn't cut down by constraints in lower strata, they would not be embedded. All right, they'll have. Who? Well, which ones? These ones are actually embedded in X with an almost complex structure. Yes, in the original X, with this ones here when C1 is positive. In the original X, but X now has an almost generic almost complex structure. It's an account of embedded J holomorphic curves in X for J generic. For J, well. Well, I'll explain sort of the statement here. You should think of it as a count of embedded J holomorphic curves the same way you think of this as a count of perturbed holomorphic maps. Okay. It's an almost complex structure on X. I'm taking X to be a symplectic threefold. So to begin with, it doesn't have any structure. I mean, other than a symplectic structure. Correct. Even if it was a Calabi-Yau, well, you actually have to do a little bit more than just deform the complex structure in the Calabi-Yau. So for a situation when C1, I'll explain this shortly. I mean, it's a bit easier if I do a bit of background, and then you'll see exactly what this means in practice. I'll show you how this is done. Excuse me, I didn't hear because I was moving the blackboard. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oops. Oh, the way I formulated it? Yes, you're right. You're right. Yes, sorry. Right. You're right. Well, so as you can see, let's see. Right. In this form, you're right. This is connected. Thanks for pointing this out. In this form, this is disconnected. However, the difference between these two is just take a logarithm or exponentiate. So now coming back to this, in fact, if you see, it's sort of, if you sort of look at it, the structure of this formula, it's sort of halfway in between this and this. So first of all, it doesn't have the 1 over d. If I sort of stated it differently, you can, when you exponentiate this and expand it in power series, this guy, you can think of them as polynomials in sine of t over 2, right? This is actually a 2, I just noticed, I noticed I forgot a 2. You can think of this as polynomials in 2 sine of t over 2. And so these will be those polynomials over there. Mm-hmm. No, not, we can't prove that, but so. Mm-hmm. You have to fix a bound. So in order to do this count, what you want to do is you have to fix a bound on the energy. That means you fix a bound on the homology class, on omega, on symplectic form on the homology class, and on the genus. And then the same J works for everything below that. Okay, but you can't do it for all, and you can't do it limited at infinity. As is usually the case for Gromov-Witten invariants, you can't find the same perturbation that works for all genera and homology classes. You have to have first a bound on energy. Once you have a bound on energy of the curve, that means a bound on the homology class and on the genus, then you can define this invariant, you can find a perturbation. Okay. All right, so, okay, so where was I? So, okay, so I was saying this is a weighted count of embedded J holomorphic curves, and before moving further, let me just finish a little bit with the motivation. So what we're expecting, so this, we should be expecting this to be just the first step. What we're really expecting is to have a similar situation like in four dimensions. So we expect to have a similar situation in four dimensions, as in four dimensions. So what do I mean by that? We would really like to prove sort of this conjecture, to have a proof of one of these two conjectures. And so far, we sort of just have a structure on the Gromov-Witten side. What is now the relation between that invariant and this invariant? Well, in four dimensions, if this invariant were given by a gauge theory, like in four dimensions, then, so let me explain the situation in four dimensions. So in four dimensions, if you take X, four real dimensions. When I think of a smooth manifold, I always think of it as a four real dimensions, but then when I think of a subsymplectic manifold, I like to think of it as in complex dimensions. So then here you see the trouble. So in four real dimensions, you take X4, a smooth manifold, and or it could also be symplectic if you wanted, or Keller. And let me go to a different blackboard. And then you have various gauge theoretical invariants you can define for it. I'll mention just a few. The list is long. But just very briefly, well, we can certainly take the Donaldson invariants. You can define them for X smooth. You can define the Seibel-Witten invariant. also for X smooth. And we can, of course, define the Gromov invariance for X symplectic, except that I want to restrict myself to a certain part of the Gromov invariant. So I'm going to look at sort of the embedded part of the Gromov-Witten invariant, which is basically denoted by Gromov, by, I mean, Taubes denoted this invariant by GR, embedded part of Gromov-Witten invariant. As denoted by GR, this would be defined for X for symplectic. And of course, these are various gauge theoretical invariants. And the point is, at the end of the day, they all carry the same amount of information. So here we have Witten's conjecture that the Donaldson invariants, after a change of variable, sort of similar to one of those. They carry the same amount of information as Simon-Witten invariant. And here we have Taub's theorem. So we can. And here we have Taub's theorem. That says the Simon-Witten invariants are equal to the embedded part of the Gromov invariant. And just for the purpose to sort of illustrate what's going to happen later, I would like to just briefly remind you the key idea in Taub's theorem. So what was the key idea in the proof of Taub's theorem? Because what we would, the plan is, in a sense, a very similar situation should be happening in three dimensions, although we don't really have so far sort of a gauge theoretical version of this invariant, although from what I understand, the physicists are almost almost there. So maybe we should use one of those theories. So what's the situation with, what's the idea of Taub's theorems? So first of all, X4 is symplectic. You choose J, an almost complex structure, on X. And then you look at holomorphic curves. Well, you have to cut them down again. So these are sort of the embedded, the expected embedded holomorphic curves. So you have to cut them down by a certain number of constraints. And the point is that in four dimensions, these embedded holomorphic curves, well, J, so you look at embedded J holomorphic curves in X. And Taub showed that, first of all, there is a finite number of these for generic J, so for generic J, there is a finite number of these. So, well, there is a certain restriction between, so in four dimensions, if you fix your homology class by a junction formula, there is the embedded genus. Right, so it's that by, but that's what I meant. Those are the curves that are given by that embedded genus. Okay, so if you fix, so well, I didn't label them anything, but this would be sort of Gromov A, and this homology class in four dimensions sort of determine GA, which is the embedded genus, by a junction formula basically. And then you count the curves with that genus. Okay. So for generic J, there is a finite number of these. And furthermore, if you take the Simon-Witten equations and you perturb them by adding a large multiple of the symplectic form, then what you're going to see is that the spinner, a certain part of the spinner, will have zeros. The limits will be, the zero set will be an embedded J holomorphic. So the limit of the zero set of the spinner, part of the equation, Simon-Witten equation. I didn't define the Simon-Witten equations, but in a certain sense, the limit is going to be, the zero set of the limit will be an embedded J holomorphic curve, well, with a possible multiplicity, plus a multiplicity. And then he reduced the ones. With these two ingredients, you basically reduce the situation to a local situation. You've got your embedded J holomorphic curve, and you ask yourself, in how many ways can I think of it as a map? Well, you have an embedded J holomorphic curve, maybe with a multiplicity, and you ask yourself, in how many ways can I think of it as a map? That's what essentially this one counts. That's what essentially Gromov-Witten invariant counts. And then from this perspective, you ask yourself, I have my embedded curve and a multiplicity. In how many ways can I think of it as a limit of this Seibel-Witten equation? So you basically, I mean, in the limit, what you see is that you're going to have vortices. Well, in the normal boundedness curve, the Seibel-Witten equations become like vortices, vortex equations in the normal boundedness curve. So in how many ways can I see this limit appearing? So you basically reduce the situation from a global situation to a local situation supported near one of these J holomorphic curves. So we'd like to have a similar situation in four dimension, and so far we're just working on the first step, showing that there is sort of a well-defined count of embedded J holomorphic curves. By the way, in tau situation, and maybe I'll say that later, this count is not a real count of embedded curves, it's a weighted count, just like you'll see it's happening here. But it's weighted in a natural way so that, in fact, the two theories match. Okay, so let's see. So that's sort of the hope, and that's the end of the motivation. Now, what is the proof of the structure theorem? Yes. Yes, yes. That's what I'm going to explain right now. And so it's all very geometric. And that's exactly. So what's the point here? So what's the idea of that structure theorem? Well, the idea is that when you look at the Gromov-Witten invariant, you can, of course, put a general perturbation and get a count, and that will give you this invariant. But we can do something less dramatic than that. We can go back to the ideas of Gromov and just take J, an almost complex structure, and then you basically look for J holomorphic maps, which means you are solving the equation del bar JF equals to zero. Now, solutions of this equation fall into two categories. So there are two kinds of solutions. The first type is what are called simple maps. The moduli space of such simple maps are denoted by M star, GA. Again, cut down by constraints, if there are any constraints to be cut down by. So what does it mean, simple map? A simple map means that on each connected component, on each sort of smooth component of the domain, the map is somewhere injective, which basically means it's not multiple covers. The other type of solution is multiple covers. Which basically mean, so here is a picture. Once you have a solution, so let me draw here a picture. There are typically two kinds of multiple covers, and then combinations of this. So what are the two different kinds of multiple covers? So the first type of multiple cover will be the following. So suppose I have, let's take for simplicity a smooth curve here, mapping in, going into X as a simple map. So that's a simple map. The image is simple. That means it's injective. Somewhere injective, but at least at some point it's injective. And then what we can do, we can take a cover of this. So we can take a degree D. So this surface has genus G. We can take a cover of some other genus H. We can take a degree D, well, possibly branch cover. And then, well, that's holomorphic if you pull back the complex structure from here. And then the composition, let me see. The composition here would actually represent in homology D times A. And it would be multiple cover. And it will also be a solution. So any such degree D branch cover gives a solution. So any branch cover of F gives a solution of the type del bar, let's call it G equals to 0. But of course, the moduli space and the moduli space of genus, some other genus, so genus H, homologous class dA of X. That's the moduli space of those solutions to the holomorphic, J holomorphic map equation. So that's one type of branch cover. And the second type of branch cover, multiple cover, is the more singular one where you have constant maps. You can also have constant maps. Of course, you know, constant map would be J holomorphic. So the other situation, B, would be constant component. So again, in the simplest situation, you have a certain map going in, still called F, representing A. But then what you can do, you can basically attach to it. So the domain, let's say for simplicity, any other, it has to be genus bigger or equal to 1 component, and just send this in as a constant map. So the image on this component is constant. This component, this whole component goes to constant. So now the composition, if you want, this combined map will also be a solution. Again, in the moduli space, the multiplicity is still, the image still represents homology class A, but of course the genus went up. This was genus G, say this one has genus H, sort of the composition, the combination gives a solution in the moduli space that still represents A, but the genus is larger, so it's G plus H. So that's the problem. I mean, this is the space of solutions of the equation. And now, what's happening? So why do you need to perturb this equation? It turns out that for simple maps, you can prove, again, let's restrict ourselves to the situation of a Calabi-Yau threefold. So, if X, not a Calabi-Yau, I meant let X be a symplectic threefold, and let's denote by MGA star the cut-down moduli space. Should you have to cut down if C1 is positive on A? So that's expected to be zero-dimensional. Of solutions, it turns out that for generic J, almost complex structure, first of all, M star GA is a zero-dimensional manifold. So it's not an orbifold, it's a zero-dimensional manifold consisting of smooth embedded disjoint curves, J holomorphic curves. So the picture here is that, and in fact, if you have a bound on energy, and I should say this, this curve in different moduli spaces are disjoint from each other. So. This way and disjoint. No, no, no. All right. So that would be the point. It doesn't hold, but for a zero dimension, it does hold. So and you'll see that it's actually not sort of relevant. I mean, well. Well, that's wait, that's also a second point. So and it's the joint. Okay, let me just get to that. So the answer to both questions is, well, yes, but if you think of it, I mean, it is a finite number. However, sort of as you vary the j, this behaves in a one-parameter family, real one-parameter family. This space of solution behaves, it's not a manifold anymore, behaves very strangely, it has ramifications, all sorts of singularities, if you want. So it's not something, at the end of the day, you really want to work with, okay? But anyway, considering a smooth embedded disjoint curve and disjoint from curves, simple curves, again, disjoint from simple curves. Of smaller energy, I'll just say, which basically means either smaller homology class or smaller genus. So the picture here in X is that what you see is that for a generic almost complex structure, let's say put a bound on energy, so bound the homology class and the genus, what you do see, you see a bunch of simple curves. They are disjoint from each other, and they are smooth embedded. And then, so if you look at the solutions of del bar j f equals to 0, such solutions will be, of course, the simple curves plus their multiple covers. So the solutions are simple curves plus multiple covers of this. So, you know, you see the simple curves. And so you've got a certain degree of a multiple cover. So that's a degree D. But you also have this constant component. And you get a different color chalk that also enter as a multiple cover. So I'm drawing sort of the image. So that's how sort of the image of the moduli space looks like. And then the point is that at this multiple cover, so this is expected dimension, zero dimension, but at this multiple covers, now it depends in which situation you are. So if you are in the KC1 of A positive, then dimension count shows that the only multiple covers you could have are of this kind. Okay, so when C1 of A is positive, these are the only ones. So you actually, in C1 of A positive, you don't have these multiplicities coming in. You just have this constant component. And then if C1 of A is 0, anything, I mean, any multiplicity and any, you have the general situation, okay? So, all right, so now what the point is that, now to get, so now what's the problem with this? The point is that the dimension of the moduli spaces both here and here of these solutions cannot be of expected dimension because notice, expected dimension, say in this case, if you, let's assume C1 of A is 0, which is the worst case scenario, say, then expected dimension is always zero dimensional. But here, once we have a solution, we can take a degree D cover branched. The space of such covers is given by the number of branch points, so we can take a large number of branch points, so we can get a moduli space of as large dimension as we want of solutions. So it's not of expected dimension, it's not zero dimensional. And the same thing here, you can attach this ghost of whatever, any genus, any complex structure at any point around here, and that gives you a larger dimensional moduli space. So in any event, these two pictures, so the multiple covers are responsible from not having a zero dimension, a moduli space of expected dimension. So then what do? You turn on a perturbation that basically breaks the symmetry in which constant maps are not anymore solutions or multiple covers like that. you know, that it breaks the symmetry. So if you turn on a generic perturbation, so you solve del bar JF equals to nu, then you'll see that only finitely many of these other configurations will perturb to real solutions, and that's how you get the Gromov-Witten invariant. But what we would like to do, we'd like to see, can we get an invariant without turning on the perturbation? So, and now going back to your question, if the number of simple curves would be finite for a generic J, so if the number of simple curves in this moduli space, M star GA, is finite for generic J, then of course we can get the count. It might or might not be an invariant, because again you have to worry, is it an invariant? That is, what happens if you vary the J in a one-parameter family? But nonetheless, you get the count, and then what you can say is that you basically turn the problem from a global problem to a local problem, and basically see that, in fact, the Gromov-Witten invariant. So here, I mean, for this discussion, as you see, it's not really important whether you are taking connected or disconnected curves. But you'll see that in some other argument it's quite important. Oops, am I out of time? AG. So I have until, I have 10 more minutes, right? Thank you. 12, okay, 12 more minutes. All right, good. So what you see is that the Gromov-Witten invariant, let me say just formally, you basically see that the Gromov-Witten invariant is basically a count of simple curves plus contributions of multiple covers. Okay, so that's sort of the moral situation. Now, why is the number of simple curves finite? Well, what you need to avoid, so what can happen? What can happen is the following. So for generic J, what can happen is that you can have an embedded curve, let's call it F0, and you can have a sequence of embedded curves, also simple curves, that's Fn, I don't know how to draw it, but you know, it should be one one curve, Fn, that what happens is that they're all simple, but as n goes to, so as n goes to infinity, you have a sequence Fn that converges as a multiple cover, of F0. So the limit of Fn, let me go to normal chalk, is F0 compose rho, so, or rho is one of those, so rho is a multiple cover. It's a cover, it's a degree D. Okay. So they cannot accumulate on curves which are still simple, but they could accumulate as multiple covers. Yes, yes, yes. So, yes, but not, I mean, very special ones. And that's the point. So it can accumulate like that. And the whole point of the discussion is to show that, to study this phenomenon, preferably in a one-parameter family, one real dimension parameter family, and see what happens. So you basically want to ask yourself, if you had a real one-parameter family, because that's relevant for the invariant, whether or not you get an invariant. If you have a real one-parameter family, can we get Fn, which are whatever, let's say Ft, which are Jt holomorphic and simple, can they converge? Is a multiple cover of F0, which is J0 holomorphic and simple. But so it's a force of multiple cover of it. Okay? And the answer is In a one-parameter family, yes, certainly this happens. So what? How can you avoid the situation? So, let's see. So what's the point here? And the answer is yes, unfortunately. Yes, I mean, it's bad, but not too bad. So let's see. So what can happen here? Let's take the very, very simple situation. So let's first take the simple case. The simplest case you can think of is this limit has no ghost components and no branch points, right? So if the simplest case is the limit, so this multiple cover has no ghost components and also no branch points. So it's an honest topological cover. So now this cover, now what happens to this, one of the reasons why this cover would cause a problem is, of course, if you have no branch points, the expected dimension of the moduli space, the moduli space still is zero dimensional. So you still don't have a too great problem. You could still count this if you want. But the problem is that they come with automorphisms. And, well, even if this Beck transformation has not automorphisms, what you need to do, you need to go to a cover, so need to go to a regular cover. By a regular cover, so notice here I have, say, a genus 2. There are degree 3 covers of a genus 2 which have no Beck transformations. However, if you go to a further cover, then you get a higher cover of it will have the group of Beck transformations acting transitively on the fiber, and so, you know, if you go higher up, then the quotient will be the space downstairs. So once you go to a regular cover, then essentially what you're doing, you are working equivariantly. So you work equivariantly with respect to the group of Beck transformations. So let me say it this way. Maybe I skipped a couple of steps here. So if you have such a limit, that means that you have a certain, in the normal direction, at least the first order, you have something in the kernel. So you have a certain direction in which this curve goes out in the normal direction, and it becomes now embedded, so sort of the trace of this limiting. So you have a kernel of the sort of the normal operator in the normal direction, and you are at such a multiple cover where the kernel is non-trivial. And what you want to argue is that the places where the kernel is non-trivial, it's at least codimension 1 real, preferably codimension 2 real, but at least codimension 1 real. And so if it's codimension 2 real, that means generically you don't have any kernel, not even in a one real parameter family, which means that this situation cannot appear even in a one-parameter family, so you get not only a count, but you get a well-defined count, which is an invariant. However, notice that for Z2 covers, again, no branch points, the Z2 covers, they have the Beck transformations are Z2, and this in a one-parameter family can have, for the normal operator, can have kernel, which is just R, one real dimension. And that imposes only one real dimensional condition, which means that, well, still generically, again, for this baby case, generically, this kind of curve don't appear as limits. However, as you move in a one-parameter family of J's, they do occur once in a while. So you have these very complicated wall-crossing formulas. Just if you restrict yourself even to just sort of the degree 2 covers with no branch points and no ghost, you have a very complicated combinatorics for the number of embedded maps. But then the point of all this is that, that's how we started, and we tried to extend this further, and it does extend. You can argue that, what you can argue is that if you modify this argument, you can argue that such curves, this curve F0, a multiple cover of F0, is isolated. So for a generic J, it's isolated from the nearby simple curves in the normal direction. So you could get a count. However, the count will not give you an invariant. It will have a very complicated ramification. So curves will appear and disappear and will have a very complicated wall crossing formula. So somehow, to get an invariant, you have to work very hard and understand all the possible bifurcations and wall crossing formulas for this. But there is actually an easier way out. And I should say that, such curves are isolated to first order. For example, if there are no branch covers, if there are no branch points, or if, for example, there are all the branch points, at branch points which are totally ramified and other things, but some of them might not be isolated to first order. You might have to go to a higher order to get them to be isolated from the guys nearby. So it's very complicated. The wall crossing formulas are very complicated. And basically that sort of, it depends how the group of Beck transformation acts, which could be in principle anything, acts on the current, how it acts on this direction that you're coming in from. And also what its representation on the ramification point. So the point of all this is that this actually doesn't matter, because you see, sort of the insight we had was, look, after all, we are only looking at J holomorphic curves, right? So we're looking at J holomorphic curves. And the point about J holomorphic curves is that even if they were allowed to concentrate like that, they have one special feature. For example, let's suppose the limit has no branch points, right? If the limit has no branch points, then what you can do, you can simply just mark this cover. Suppose you are counting connected covers. What you can just do, you can simply mark, say, for example, fix here a fiber, and mark a point on the domain, and then so look at the solutions to the equation del bar jx f equals to 0, where x, you want x to be sent to this fixed fiber here. So you basically go to a cover of the moduli space. Typically, if this is a degree D, in the limit you'd have a degree D branch cover, you'd go to a degree D cover of the moduli space if it's connected. But the advantage of this is now there are no automorphisms. So there are no Beck transformations which preserve a point. The only Beck transformation which preserves the point is the identity. So you don't actually need to work equivariantly. You just work you just basically get the space of solutions here to this equation. It's simply a manifold without any trouble at all. So, no more non-trivial Beck transformations. And so that's what you get. You get an invariant that's sort of, it's sort of the equivalent. You get the count, which is, really, it should be like D times the Gromov-Witten invariant, A. Let's say it this way. You get the count. From this, you get the count Gromov. If you count this kind of solution in which you allow the complex structure to depend on the point of the domain, you get a count here. Right now it's a fraction if I do it connected covers. But nonetheless, the advantage of this is right now this curve, once you allow your complex structure to depend on the domain, in fact, these curves are all becoming embedded. In other words, they have no automorphisms once you go to a cover. Right? Once you mark this point, which means you have a choice of D points to mark. But once you mark those points, these curves simply have no automorphism, and you get an integer invariant by counting the space of solutions to this problem without any constant. So this is the number of solutions without any constant maps attached to it. You can count this and get an invariant. And then the point is that once you do this, once you turn on the perturbation like that, the only solutions you still have left are this kind of solutions, which are now finitely many, and I mean smooth and everything you want about them. Once you do this, and then the only other solutions to the equation del bar J X F equals to zero are now just multiple covers. I mean, sorry, ghosts. So the only other thing you can have is just a bunch of ghosts attached to it, attached to them. I'll say in a second what happened to the branch points. So let's first assume there are no branch points, okay? I mean, well, okay. So if there are no branch points, you can basically what you're ending up counting is a space of covers of this map. If you want to do disconnected covers, which is the best way, you are counting the number of disconnected covers of this map with a certain sign, and that's actually so you, what you end up, at the end of the day, you get an integer if you count disconnected, greedy disconnected covers, right? But if you were to just, I mean, if you were to mark a point, I mean, if they were connected covers, you need to mark a point, right? And only after you mark a certain point to kill the deck transformation, you get an integer. So, but you are counting curves without any ghost components here. And the point, let me just say it. So the point, I mean, the whole point of that formula that I wrote at the beginning is that this invariant is the count of Gromov-Witten, so the count of solutions to this equation in which you remove the ghost components, okay? And there is this formula that says if you have a, I mean, it's very easy to show now that if you just now attach to an embedded curve, I mean, to a solution to this, which is now an embedded curve, some ghost components, its contribution. So the Gromov-Witten invariant, so now when you turn on the perturbation and these ghosts get rounded off, its contribution is exactly 2 sine of t over 2 to the power 2g minus 2 well plus t1 of a, which is the term I had over there. So somehow that was the whole explanation. I mean, somehow the point of this is that that term of 2 sine t over 2 is just a count of ghost components. And then what you have left is sort of the essential count of Gromov invariant. So now let me tell you what happens to the branch cover. So you see, if you look at the solutions, if you look at holomorphic maps, so you don't want Turner perturbation. So you only want to look at holomorphic maps. Even if you look in a family of J's, these holomorphic maps, the ones, this one over here, which are simple, in fact, you can sort of see their branch points to begin with. So you can look at the projection, and the projection actually has this branch point. And what you can do now with this branch point is that, what you want to do with these maps in the simplest version is to mark them, right? So what you have a marking. In the moment where you mark the way they intersect the fiber, right? As long as you mark them at the point which is not a branch point, there are no more deck transformations. Right. So now you have to make sure that what happens is that you first of all, as you do this, you want to make sure that first of all, the point where you marked, you don't have a branch point, you don't have your point that you marked running into a branch point, and you also want to make sure you don't have any ghost components bubbling off, right, where you would have a loss of branch point, and also that would have automorphisms. So the point there is what you do. I mean, at the end of the day, the reason why this is a sort of a creative count is what you do when you pass the limit, you first mark the points here. You look at the location of the branch point. By the branch points, I mean you look at this projection. This projection actually has branch points. If this was simple, a simple J holomorphic curve, this projection here actually has a number of branch points. And now what you do when you pass the limit, you just rescale in such a way so those branch points don't collide. You rescale the target around here, around the curve, so they go on a bubble. And also you don't allow them to collide with your marking. So you basically end up, in the limit, what you end up in the simple situation, if you had branch points, you end up with a cover of your curve plus a bunch of P1s attached to it. Okay. And so that's where your branch points would go if they were to collide, or maybe if they were to hit your point. But now what you have upstairs is a cover of this type. So again, there are no ghost components. and you can arrange that in the limit. The point you marked is never a branch point. So if you do that, that means there are actually no deck transformations. Because, I mean, if a deck transformation preserves this point, it would have to be the identity on this component. And in fact, you can check, even if this is a higher order tangency, because of the way these things are matched, it would actually have to be, in fact, identity. You look at the roots of unity. It would actually have to be the identity on this component as well. Okay. So in a sense, somehow this marking, this marking has the advantage that once you mark, your curves have no automorphisms anymore. And so you're going to get an integer invariant once you do the marking. Now, the problem is that, of course, to do the marking, you have to go to a cover, right? And to put the marking, if you have a disconnected cover, you have to go, there are de factorial ways of choosing this marking over the fiber. But, let's see. Let me try to say it this way. Let me try to see. I guess what I'm trying to say is the point is that at the end of the day, what you can think of, you are counting not really embedded curves, but sort of embedded curves with sort of a certain monodromy data over them that corresponds to this, representations of pi 1 of C into the symmetric group. And so, the space of solutions there is, in fact, you actually get and end up getting an integer invariant if you count disconnected covers. And that also makes sense from the other perspective because, if you were to look at the limit, somehow, even from the Thybutian point of view, when you have these vortices converging as a multiple cover of a torus, right before they converge, you can still get this sort of, you can still look at them and see what kind of cover they converged as. So you can still keep sort of remember this monodromy data, this finite monodromy data. Right. They have to. What you have to do, you have to make them lie in a fiber. So the point is a simple curve. So first of all, what you do is you have a simple curve here downstairs, and you are going to pick a point. I don't know, y on the simple curve downstairs. And then you are going to look at simple curves in a neighborhood of this F0 that, this is just J holomorphic. Now for generic J, for this particular fiber that you fixed and this particular F0 that you fixed, for a generic J in the normal bond, in normal direction, not normal bond, but this whole normal neighborhood, this simple curve will not be tangent. Will not have a branch point there.
I guess what I don't understand is that the position of your curve is determined, the position
of the simple curve is determined by the
position of the
curve and the by being J polynomial. Yes. And so the position point, do you
just
play the wheel
or is it constrained by something, or
you fix it. I mean, just pick it randomly on the simple curve, on the base simple curve where you limit at. You can do this in a more symmetric way, but in the first approximation. With bounded genus, right? But that send that particular point to this very fixed particular point, without any. I don't know if this answers your question, but somehow the point is that you can remove the ghost component contribution, and you are just left with simple branch covers to deal with, and this can be the simple branch covers. Once you mark them at a point which is not a branch point, you can deal with them by some sort of finite combinatorial data. Once you turn on the perturbation, which depends on those. Okay, so maybe that. Yeah, sorry, I know I ran out of time. Maybe I should stop. Wait.